This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to listen in again this week. On the program this week, I'll be talking with Mr. Jeffrey Frankel, and I'll be talking with Mr. Carl Denninger. You know, it's nice to present many different perspectives, and that's what I try to do here on the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. My first guest, Mr. Jeffrey Frankel, is an economic optimist. He believes the odds of a recession in the United States are low, and he believes the May jobs report, which was not good, was an aberration. I disagree, respectfully. I am an economic pessimist due to reasons that really historically have proven that I have really good grounds to stand on when it comes to being an economic pessimist. When private sector debt levels are this high, economic downturns have always followed, historically speaking. And when you look at private sector debt levels today, they're 50% higher than they were at the beginning of the Great Depression when measured as a percentage of the U.S. economy. I believe the U.S. may already be in recession, and I believe that the unemployment rate is low simply because people are dropping out of the labor force. And when potential workers drop out of the labor force and quit looking for a job, they're no longer considered among those who are unemployed. They're no longer considered to be part of the labor force. So I want to present you my interview with Mr. Jeffrey Frankel, and then I will also be talking with Mr. Carl Denninger on today's podcast about the Hillary Clinton email investigation that was just concluded this past week by the FBI. We'll get his take. He's got some very strong opinions I think you'll find interesting. And I'll also get Carl's take on Brexit. And is it the first of many, and what will it mean for you and your money? So a lot to talk about on today's podcast. We'll go ahead and get started. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the program, Jeffrey A. Frankel. Dr. Frankel is the James W. Harpel Professor of Capital Formation and Growth. He directs the program in International Finance and Macroeconomics at the National Bureau of Economic Research, where he's also on the Business Cycle Dating Committee, which officially declares recessions. He served at the Council of Economic Advisors in 1983 and 1984, and then again in 1996 to 1999. He received his PhD in economics from MIT. He also writes a monthly op-ed at Project Syndicate. And Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dennis. Good to be with you.
So, Jeffrey, let's talk about recent news that is on everyone's mind. The Brexit vote, where the country of Britain, or the citizens of the country of Britain, I guess more correctly, voted to leave the European Union. What do you view as being the long-term implications of this vote on world trade?
Well, it has big economic implications for Britain itself and for the rest of Europe. I'm not sure that the long-term implications for the United States, economically speaking, or world trade are all that great. Britain isn't that large an economy. For us, I think probably the larger concerns would be sort of geopolitical.
So I'm reminded in my own research and in interviews I've done that, when economies worldwide back in the 30s tended to weaken, there was this growing protectionist movement and nationalistic movement. Do you think that what we're seeing here in the terms of the Brexit vote is the beginning of a global movement in that regard?
Well, that is a worrisome possibility, and if so, it isn't quite the beginning. I mean, we've been seeing it for a few years. Overall, when the global recession hit starting in the U.S. at the end of 2007, but really late 2008, many people, particularly we economists who tend to be pro-trade overall, were concerned that because the magnitude of the shock was on the order of magnitude of the Great Depression of the 30s, that, among other things, that maybe there would be this backlash, turning back the clock of globalization and trade, and that would, among other things, would worsen the economic downturn as it did in the 1930s. Overall, I, I would say that hasn't happened. I mean, in terms of protectionist trade barriers, countries actually enacting them. After 2008, the G7, G20 leading countries sort of agreed not to do that. And, you know, relatively speaking, I think they did pretty well. I mean, if you even compare it to, let's say, the early 80s, after the 81-82 recession, which up to that point was the worst since the 30s, overall, we have not had such a big increase in trade barriers. Now, there is this remarkable slowdown in trade nonetheless, which has taken place over the last decade. Trade is growing much less rapidly than it did before. That's true even relative to GDP. And it's certainly possible, to get back to your question, that we're seeing, as has been so widely remarked, that the Brexit vote is just one aspect of movement throughout many countries in Europe and the United States of kind of, you know, revolt by people who feel that they've been left behind by globalization and economic integration.
So tell me, Jeffrey, what your view is. Assess the world economy and the U.S. economy in terms of, are we crouching back toward recession? Are we headed in that direction? Or what's your view?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think for the U.S., I don't think the odds of recession, you know, in the coming year are much greater than any random year. The odds of recession for the U.K., Great Britain, are pretty high, and this is actually a very rare circumstance where economic forecasters, particularly in Britain, are, a majority of them are forecasting a recession even, you know, before there's any direct statistics. That actually is extremely rare. People tease economists for, you know, not having forecast this recession or that recession. But basically, we never forecast recessions until there's at least some, indication in the data, because, you know, it's just too unpredictable. But this is a rare case that, given the magnitude of the shock, a lot of people are forecasting that for Britain. More generally, I don't really see a departure from the basic pattern, which has held ever since the trough of the recession, which was early 2009. Namely, the U.S. has had a slow, steady recovery, not as strong as we would like, but, you know, pretty steady, and one that looks pretty good compared to everyone else, not just Britain now, but, Europe basically never did recover from that, from the global financial crisis. Countries like Italy, their GDP is well below what it was at the peak, whereas we're way above it. And Japan has really been stuck in the doldrums. And then the emerging markets, the developing countries, who did have quite a strong recovery in from 2000, late 2009, 2010, 2011, China and other Asian countries, and especially the commodity exporters, had a strong recovery. But they have gone into a slowdown in the last few years. So basically almost everyone besides us is doing worse, and so we've seen a divergence over the last few years, and that's sort of my base case, is that probably will continue.
Well, we are chatting today with Jeffrey Frankel, and the bad news is that we're out of time for this segment. The good news is we'll have Jeffrey back for another conversation in the next segment when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. I certainly hope you're enjoying Mr. Jeffrey Frankel's perspective. I'll get back to the rest of my conversation with him. I'm pleased to be chatting today with Jeffrey Frankel. Jeffrey is the James W. Harpel Professor of Capital Formation and Growth at the Harvard Kennedy School. He directs the program in International Finance and Macroeconomics at the National Bureau of Economic Research, where he's also on the Business Cycle Dating Committee, which officially declares recessions. He writes a monthly op-ed at Project Syndicate, And Jeffrey, in the last segment, you made the case that, in your view, the U.S. really wasn't headed for recession, or I think you said the odds for recession in this year aren't really, in your view, any greater than in any other year. But when you look at the jobs report, the good news was that the headline unemployment rate declined. When you dig below the surface, though, and look at the numbers, a lot of that is because a number of folks left the labor force. There's a lot of people working part-time involuntarily. And, 38,000 new jobs in the last jobs report is pretty dismal. Is that an aberration, or in your view, is that going to continue?
So you're talking about one number that, for May, and it was quite a disappointing number, that's right. But I don't have to tell you that there's a lot of noise in the monthly numbers, and they even tell different stories. There's the two ways we measure employment, the household survey and the payroll survey. One really wants to take a longer-term look at it, and if you do that the last year, or for that matter, the entire period since since the trough of the recession, the labor market story is actually pretty good, the rate of job creation. So total non-farm jobs, 13 million since the middle of 2009, which is 155,000 per month. That's pretty good. By contrast, if you look at the period from 2001 to 2007, so leave out the recession of 2001 and leave out the recession that started in December 2007, just look at the period of the last recovery. That was 7 million total jobs, not much more than half of what we've seen recently, and at a monthly rate that was 99,000 per month. And if you look at private jobs, the contrast is even greater. So on that statistic, things actually look pretty good. Now, it's true that the labor force is down. Some of that is to be expected because ever since the turn of the century, trend in the overall labor force is down because of the baby boom generation beginning to retire, but that's casting it in a positive light, and it certainly needs to be said. Instead of just looking at that one negative number for jobs in January, but it is a reminder that the recovery has overall been disappointing.
Well, let's shift gears a minute, Jeffrey, and talk a bit about Fed policy. We saw a quarter point rate increase back in December. Since then, nothing. What's your forecast for Fed policy moving ahead for the rest of 2016?
Well, I think we're not going to see a whole lot of action. I mean, supposedly markets were expecting, or commentators at the beginning of the year were expecting four increases in 2016, that the Fed would raise their policy interest rate four times. And they said that because of what's called the dots plot at the time. But I think that never was very likely. And it seems to me that there's kind of the financial markets where we certainly are seeing a lot of volatility, have been seeing a lot of volatility so far this year and actually for the last year. I think the financial markets are overreacting a bit to every tiny bit of news about what the Fed might do implied or inferred from some speech that Janet Yellen gives. And overreacting to developments in China, for example. So we've seen this kind of swinging back and forth. I think they're going to put it on hold. I mean, one implication of the Brexit vote in the UK is that the dollar is up sharply because the dollar, as much as it's ever been, is a safe haven currency. And so we've switched once again into this risk-off mode, meaning investors are pulling out of any more securities that are seen as more uncertain, which includes emerging markets, includes junk bonds, it includes equities, and they're going into treasury securities, and they're going into the dollar, and the dollar has strengthened yet again, which has been part of the pattern of the last 3 years, one of the consequences of this divergence between the U.S. and the rest of the world. Well, given the tightening in the dollar, I think and given the uncertainty that's out there, I think the Fed is going to put further interest rate increases on hold for quite a while.
Yeah, I certainly talked to a number of guest experts here on the program that agree. I've also interviewed guest experts that think that the Fed will be forced to rescind the rate increase, cut rates, and potentially entertain the idea of another quantitative easing program. What would you say to that particular opinion?
I would say not on current trends, not on current data. And by the way, so in other words, it would require a substantial worsening in the numbers, in the growth rate, and the jobs numbers, which of course is not impossible with these latest shocks. And by the way, if that happened, I would not be one of those who would necessarily say that the Fed made a mistake in raising interest rates a quarter point in December. I don't think they should feel that they can't reverse themselves if economic situations reverse. But as of now, I don't see it. I think if anything, given some of the deviations on the downside in the numbers, the jobs number in May and the growth number in the first two numbers in the first two quarters, if anything, I might see slightly stronger economic performance in the second half of this year, notwithstanding the enormous uncertainties posed by developments with respect to Brexit.
Well, we are out of time. Our guest today has been Jeffrey Frankel. He is the James W. Harpel Professor of Capital Formation and Growth at Harvard Kennedy School, and he writes a monthly op-ed at Project Syndicate. And Jeffrey, we certainly appreciate you joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Next on this week's podcast, joining me will be Mr. Carl Denninger. Carl is a prolific economic and political commentator. I'll be talking with him about the Hillary Clinton email investigation that was just concluded by the FBI this past week. I'll be getting his take. And then later on in the podcast, I'll be talking to him about the economy. Joining me once again on today's program is frequent guest Mr. Carl Denninger. Carl is a prolific economic and political commentator. And Carl, welcome back to the program, and thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Carl, let's start by talking about the headlines this week. This is really a show where we talk about finance and the economy, but we can't help but talk a little politics now and then, and we had the FBI director this past week come out, make some comments, and then decide that at least their agency anyway would not recommend any enforcement action against Hillary Clinton. And now you have some strong views on that, and you've researched that topic. Can you comment?
Well, sure. What the director of the FBI said is that there is no rule of law in the United States. He has essentially destroyed the American experiment, if you will. America died on July 5th, 2016, 240 years and one day after it was born. What Director Comey said on national television was that Hillary Clinton did with great disregard for her responsibilities, that is, great carelessness, mishandle classified information through the use of her private email server. That, by the way, gross negligence is the standard that is required under the law in order to prosecute. He also, at the same time, laid forward the facts that she committed multiple acts of perjury, all of which are felonies, because she made statements that were directly contrary to the facts that were discovered in front of Congress, and lying to Congress is a crime. So he laid forth these facts in a news conference and then said, but no reasonable prosecutor would bring this case. Well, the entire point of determining whether or not someone did something with improper intent is to look at why they did something, why they took a particular set of actions. Hillary Clinton did not set up her email server because she believed that the ones that the State Department ran were insecure or were exposing classified information to our enemies. She did it because she sought to conceal from the public anything that she was doing and make it possible for her to not have to comply with Freedom of Information Act requests. That's the reason she did what she did. That in and of itself is improper. And so everything else that flows from there is also improper. I've worked on projects that you're not supposed to talk about, and a large number of my friends not only have but currently do. And there are people today that are literally sitting in Leavenworth for doing this sort of thing. That's a federal military prison. You can go to jail for real for this sort of thing. And what James Comey actually said in his news conference was that he was not saying that if somebody else had done this or did it in the future, that he wouldn't bring charges. So essentially what James Comey said is that there is no rule of law if you happen to be well-connected or politically powerful. And let me point out to everyone that this is not about, for the most part, Hillary Clinton. Virtually everything that we face economically and socially within our country right now, what's destroying this nation, the healthcare monopolies, as a prime example, it's one of the most important ones, is taking place in a way that, in my opinion, violates long-standing, 100-year-plus-old federal law. And what James Comey said on national television is that those people are immune from prosecution for violating federal law because they're rich, because they're powerful, because they run big corporations or are large corporations, just like someone who is a powerful politician. Well, there is no point in attempting to run an honest business. There is no point in trying to be the little guy. There is no point in doing any of these things and trying to advance the American economy and the American experiment if someone who is large, powerful, and rich can step all over the law and do whatever they want. But if you try to do the same thing, you're going to go straight to jail. There is no possible way for you to win in that environment. It's impossible. And that is what James Comey set forward. That's what he did. He confirmed it. Now, this has been, of course, suspected by people forever, but to have the actual head of the federal law enforcement system come out and say this on national television is unbelievable. For the American people to sit still for this, that we do not currently have mass demonstrations all over the country, peaceful, but mass demonstrations, is an outrage. And if this is what the people of this country are going to do, that's fine. That is up to each individual person in America. But what you're saying is that you're ratifying and saying it's okay. When you get ripped off at the hospital, it's okay. When you get ripped off by a drug company, it's okay. When some cell phone company refuses to update your device and makes you buy another one because they colluded with a manufacturer and the manufacturers of the software, and your equipment gets hacked into and your data gets stolen, it's okay. When all these things happen, it's okay. It's okay because you allowed it to happen. We get the government we allow and that we deserve in this nation. And what you just heard the director of the FBI say is that if you are a rich or powerful person, or a rich or power, whether it be a politician, business person, whatever have you, the law does not apply to you. It only applies to everybody else, people like you and I.
And Carl, you know, there's I was watching as we're recording this just a few days before it airs. I was watching some of the reactions, and there's already huge distrust. Just going back to Hillary Clinton, I think I saw that 70% of Americans almost have said that she's not honest and not trustworthy, and 80% of Americans feel like the system is rigged against the little guy, and that there's two systems of justice. So, given that that's how America feels, why do you think that there is a disconnect between how they feel and what they're actually doing?
I have no idea, but to expect anyone in that environment to aspire to do anything other than become one of the protected class is crazy. I mean, when you really think about it, what are we talking about there? We're talking about royalty, right? This is the privilege that throughout the ages has been accorded to kings. And how do you become a king? Well, you get born to the right family, or the hard way. And we all know, you know, that's the violent way. But the normal way that you become a king is you get born into the right family, and that's what gives you the privilege. Well, you know, look at what we have here with a fact pattern. We have a family that has done this sort of thing throughout its time in the public eye, going all the way back to when Hillary Clinton was a lawyer before she was Hillary Clinton, when she was Hillary Rodham. And yet these sorts of activities have gone on since, greater and lesser, but at the end of the day, you know, where are the consequences for people who do this sort of thing? And people say, well, you know, just, you know, don't vote for her, vote for the other guy. Folks, that's not the point, okay? Hillary Clinton, no matter who's president, president is a small power office when you really get down to it. Look at what goes on in Washington, D.C. every single day, the impact on your budget, the impact on the United States and your family. The damage that goes on from these policies are tiny when we're talking about the presidency. What we're really talking about here is how much of what you make, of what you earn, of what you do is stolen through activities like this on a daily basis. Not just your rights, but your funds, your property, everything you hold dear. Your children are being saddled with $100,000 or more worth of debt to go to a school to get a worthless degree. The colleges know this. They themselves, along with the loan providers, have lobbied the Congress to make it impossible to discharge that debt through bankruptcy, making it special to have the same status as child support. And then we wonder why we have kids that get talked into this. You are coerced into providing financial information in order for them to even get a scholarship now. Right? All of these things are, you know, they all start small. All of these insults begin as tiny little events, but they grow over time, and this is the corrosive environment that we live in today.
Well, we are chatting today with Mr. Carl Denninger. That's all the time we have for this segment. However, we will be back in the next segment and continue our conversation with Carl when Everything Financial Radio returns. Hope you'll stay with us.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Well, I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Carl Denninger. I'll get back to that conversation now. I have the pleasure of chatting today again with my old friend Carl Denninger. And Carl, that means you've been on the program as a guest for a long time. It has nothing to do with when you were born. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. And I want to chat with you in this segment a little bit about what's going on in the economy. You know, when you look at what the revised jobs report was back for March and April, and the May jobs report, I think 38,000 jobs created, pretty dismal. The Fed obviously now is balking on the rate increases they were talking about. Are we seeing the beginning of what we've been talking about, this deflationary environment?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, let's get down to brass tacks here. What the Federal Reserve has done, and has done essentially continuously since the Greenspan era, is pull forward demand by ever lower interest rates at a macroeconomic level. So essentially what that does is add to the leverage factor within the economy as a whole. And leverage is just simply the multiplier. But problem with doing this is that you can only do it for so long. You eventually run out of there is a floor, okay? The zero interest rate really is a boundary. If you go negative, as has been postulated as the next step, what you end up actually doing is destroying capital. So there really is a boundary beyond which if you go, you get the reverse impact, and people are beginning to find this out as we actually have negative rates across much of the curve in the world. And so basically what you have done is taken all of this accumulated malinvestment and poor decision-making that is driven by this and continually accelerate it, because the singular goal of these policies is to prop up asset prices. It's specifically stocks and real estate. Right? And the reason is that's the source of everybody's leverage. That's where it all has concentrated itself over the years. And so now what we have in the real economy is people are saying, well, you know, gee, even though I can turn the crank a little further because these low rates exist, I don't see any benefit in doing it. And the person funding that is lending the money, has nothing he can earn by doing the lending, right? Because, of course, you know, the benefit to you as a borrower is a detriment to the person doing the lending. So we're now at the point where the underlying weakness is starting to be exposed, and the problem is that you're forced into this corner where to maintain that level of leverage doesn't provide any added economic benefit, but to reverse it would cause a catastrophic collapse. And you're starting to see pieces of this happen over in Europe right now. That was kind of the place I was looking for it next, was, you know, we had our turn in 2007, 2008. And the Brexit vote has exposed the fact that, for example, Italy's banks are insolvent. Well, they've been insolvent for years, but it's been hidden. And now it is starting to come to the forefront. So will they try to contain it with yet more games? I'm sure they will. But remember that in 2007, we were told that these two little hedge funds that blew up, that Bear Stearns was running, were just an isolated incident and didn't really mean anything. How'd that work out for everyone?
Point well taken. You know, when you talk about the Brexit vote, Carl, we predictably saw the British pound just plummet against other world currencies, which obviously in the short term makes British exports look more attractive. And the stronger dollar obviously is probably not helping the U.S. economy. So given that, you know, Britain may see some short-term positive impact from this, do you think that now we're going to see pretty much a run away from the Eurozone? I mean, when you take a look at the troubles that are there and take a look at what the consequences are for countries to stay in, is are we going to see more of this in an effort to try to just maintain positive exports or to make the export game more positive?
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. Remember that Brexit was more about chain migration and forced immigration of people who had no reasonable set of job skills or decision to integrate into their new society than economics. What you essentially had happen, and still is happening in Brussels, is that there are millions of refugees being taken in that are culturally incompatible with the land in which they're coming into. They're not willing to assimilate. They have not found jobs. Many of them now have been there for a couple of years. And yet, less than 1%, by some figures that I've seen, have actually gone on to find productive employment of any kind. And so essentially, what you have done is taken in wards of the state that culturally are incompatible with the people that you know, in the land that they go to. And so not only are you asking people to pay for them to be there, literally pay to live, as opposed to be productive members of society, you're also saying at the same time that these are people that don't share our cultural values. And so, for example, they believe that it's perfectly acceptable to assault young girls in a changing room at a public pool. and of course, do we in Western society think that's completely out of line and is something we won't tolerate? So how do you square those two things? You know, it's one thing to have somebody that is on the public dole and is fleeing a war-torn country. But realistically, what folks need to understand here is that there's two prongs to this, and Brexit was as much about that as it was about economics. Having your economic policy shoved down your throat with no political representation is absolute suicide. The European Union, by original design, was broken for that reason. You had essentially a trade union, which would have worked. But then when you tried to take a monetary union put on top of it, so Greece, for example, has the same set of interest rate policies as does Germany, what you are always going to end up doing in that environment is transferring a great deal of money from one to the other. And eventually the people that you're stealing it from are going to say no more because they're not getting any benefit back. They don't see a trade benefit in it, and they certainly don't see an economic benefit from it. So why should they pay? And that's the question that ultimately got asked, and then you add on to it the refugee problem, and the people of Britain said, no, no more.
So are there going to be more referendums similar to the referendum or the vote that was held in Britain?
I believe so, and there will be a great deal of effort made from the EU side to make this as painful as possible for the British. They will do everything in their power to set a bad example, because if you get another large nation that successfully votes via referendum to do this, the European Union is over. It's done.
Well, I think that when you take a look at the comment that you made, that when you have an economic union but no political union, you know, it's flawed from the get-go, and now we're seeing cracks in the foundation there as well. Carl, we've got about a minute left. You want to make a prediction as to where we end up on November 9? What the new landscape looks like politically as far as the president is concerned?
I don't know that it matters. I mean, I certainly think that the odds favor a Republican administration at this point in time, but I also think that we're in for some economic problems. And for those who think that the powers that be will keep all the balls in the air until after the election is over, at least, I just want everybody to remember that was the same prediction that was made in the spring and the summer of 2008, and we all know what happened with Lehman Brothers, right? So. And the resulting fallout. I think you need to be very careful here. The instabilities that are in the system now and the multiples that are being commanded for asset prices are well above anything that was happening in 2007 and early 2008. So the danger is much higher.
Yeah, and I think we've said here many times on the program that there are storm clouds on the horizon, and it will hit. In our view, just a matter of when. So, Carl, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll come back.
You bet, anytime. Thank you.
Well, that concludes the Everything Financial Radio podcast for this week. If you're not yet a subscriber to my newsletter titled Portfolio Watch, it's easy to subscribe. Simply visit the website yourportfoliowatch.com and sign up. That's your, Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. And when you become a subscriber, every Friday after market close, you'll get my economic and market commentary. There's no reason not to go sign up. That's how the podcast is fueled. I'd encourage you to do so. Again, the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. That's my program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Bye.